What's poppin', y'all? My name is Phyllis McKenzie, and welcome to Caralife Podcast. If you love the expression of creativity in visual, performing, literary, and culinary arts, then this is the podcast for you. So subscribe and follow our social media pages through the link in the description and be part of the family. Now, let's dive into today's episode. Okay, welcome everybody to a brand new week on Caralife Podcast. And today I'm joined by a brand new guest. And our guest today is quite peculiar because you'll find him confusing. He's a chef who is a doctor. And he's a cardiologist and a professional chef. But also in the sidelines, he's a professor in culinary medicine. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce to you Dr. Chef Mike. Welcome so much, and thank you for agreeing to be part of this episode.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm absolutely delighted to be here, so thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's begin by telling us who you are. Who was Mike way before he ventured into culinary medicine? Where did he grow up? How did he stumble upon this career and all that?
Well, I'm a native New Yorker, so I was born in the South Bronx, me and J-Lo hanging in the South Bronx back in the day. And then we moved around a lot because of my dad's work growing up. These were the days before the internet, way back in those dark ages. And so as kind of always being the new kid because we were always moving about, my mom was a great cook, and she would watch Julia Child and Graham Kerr and have cookbooks. And when I came home, she was always sort of messing about in the kitchen, cooking what she'd watched on TV those days. And so the kitchen was always a place for me in terms of kind of a sanctuary to go, you know, a friendly atmosphere. So I learned cooking skills really from my mom kind of at an early age. And then when I went off to college, it was very natural for me, making some money to help pay to get through college to go into the food industry. And so having cooked, you know, with my mom, I thought I was a great cook, you know, they're going to put me right up on the line. And I went in there and they said, hey, we got a job as a dishwasher. So I started, my professional culinary career washing dishes for a couple months, and they kept their word. And when the position opened up on the line, I became a short order cook and then went to another restaurant. And eventually, by the time I left college, I was what we call today an executive chef or sous chef, you know, running the back of the house pretty much by myself. And I always kept that love of food and the food experience, and obviously went off to medical school, became a cardiologist. So there's always still sort of a strong food connection. I eventually went back to culinary school and got a degree in gourmet cooking and catering. And, and you know, as my career developed, you know, what I really noticed was when I would go talk to the folks, my background in cardiology was for the most part very heavy and academic. So I was always kind of in a teaching environment, and we talked to folks. What people really wanted to know, they didn't want to know so much about, well, this cholesterol does this and these are your risk factors and take it back. They want to know, what can I eat? You know, this is about my life. What can I eat? And, particularly after one talk that I gave, I was talking to the folks who had arranged that outreach to the public, and she told me, she said, well, you know, my husband runs a catering company. Can you cook? And I was like, I'm a professional chef. Of course I could cook. And so that was really sort of how culinary medicine for me got born. And, you know, over the ensuing years, that's that love, that passion of food and health, and really a necessity for it because there's so much misinformation. You know, one of the big drivers there was basically all the patients are confused because all the information's confusing. And, you know, I do this full time. I'm out there researching the data, looking things up, and it's hard to stay abreast because there's so much contradictory information. And so to tease out, you know, what's real, what's misinformation, what's being pushed because it, you know, generates a nice profit for somebody. There's politics that come into play. So there's a lot there. And, eventually, after a couple books, I hooked up with my dean at the University of Montana, and that's where today in the College of Health we teach the culinary medicine course. We just launched our version to the public this summer, so just about 6 months ago, we actually put the same course that we teach, which is a graduate level course for students, to the public, and people can actually get a micro credential now in culinary medicine from the university. My appointment is in the College of Health and also the Culinary Arts Program, which we have at the University of Montana. So I have dual faculty appointments at the university to teach culinary medicine.
Okay, like I mentioned to you before even knowing about you, I had absolutely no idea what culinary medicine is. And my mom herself is a chef and a hotelier. She has been a sous chef for 6 years, way before I was born. And right now, she's like making apprentices and teaching them the ways of culinary arts. But even to her, she doesn't know what culinary medicine is. So could you please tell us, like, in a brief, memorable way, what is culinary medicine? Because it's very confusing. What's being treated here? You, the food and you. I'm not getting it.
Well, it's actually pretty simple. So if we look at the culinary arts are about living in the moment, right? It's about the experience of the moment. You go into a restaurant, a chef is preparing something for you for that moment, for your happiness in the moment. And quite frankly, I mean, the only difference is that culinary medicine is not concerned with just that moment in time. So we want to pick our ingredients and our techniques to generate happiness, to generate health, which is associated with long-term happiness, in what we call a food experience, but we want to understand the implications over time. So that is really the difference. So a chef, and I've cooked professionally, right? I'm just whatever you want. It's about that food experience. It's about your pleasure in all aspects, the taste, the food. I want you to feel good when you finish your meal. In culinary medicine, I want all those things, but I'm looking towards your health down the long term. And so that might change the ingredients that I use, right? So I might use things that not only taste great, so you have pleasure in the food experience of the moment, but it's going to bring you health down the road. So that's really the difference. One perspective is just focused here and now, have a meal, be happy. One is about, hey, you're going to have that meal and be happy today, tomorrow, next week, a year down, and that's how we want to pursue food. So it's all about and just so the folks are clear, you can go on the internet. I think there's like 23 million hits if you Google culinary medicine. So it's an emerging discipline, and many people have a different flavor. Their own flavor of culinary medicine, depending on the background that you have. So this is ours, and an important difference of what we do at the university is all of our recommendations are what we call evidence-based. So we're looking at the scientific studies. This isn't Mike's opinion. Sometimes it is Mike's opinion, and Mike will tell you when it's my opinion. But for the most part, particularly when we look at things like, well, what about red meat and saturated fat and cholesterol? What about salt? Should we cut it back? Can we add it? These sorts of things. What effects do spices and herbs have? When we're looking at that, we're really pulling that information from the best evidence base we have. And finally, really, the other thing that makes our approach to culinary medicine unique is that it's what we call multidisciplinary. So a lot of culinary medicine are kind of nutrition classes with a tasty kale recipe. And we have traditional nutrition, which is a very young science, being only about 100 years old, has really failed us for about the last 50. So if you go back to the 1970s when the nutrition recommendations first came out, people followed those nutrition recommendations. And today we're stuck with, you know, more obese people, epidemic proportions of diabetes, heart disease, all these disabilities and diseases of modern life. So following that nutritional recommendation, which, right, is what's confusing people. Don't eat eggs. Okay, eggs are okay. Maybe you can have egg whites. Don't eat saturated fat. Can't have any avocados. Avocados are great for you. They're a power food. I mean, people are just confused because the information is confusing, often because of the perspective that we take. So in culinary medicine, we're looking not only in nutrition, but we're looking at why we choose things. So what are the cultural drivers of what we choose? What are the societal influences? Things like mindfulness. And the scientific data, for example, shows that how we approach our food, the relationship we establish with our food is very, very important because it's a foundation, it's a template for other relationships in our lives. And when we look at something like the Harvard Happiness Study, which looked at people over many generations and said, they asked a real simple question. They said, no matter what background you come from in this country, the U.S., no matter where you grow up, et cetera, no matter what your job is, no matter how much money you make, what is it that kind of correlates to people living a long life, living a healthy life, living a happy life, maintaining their cognitive faculties into their elder years? What are those things? What matters? Is it the money? Is it the job you have? Is it the social class you were born into? You know, what is it? Is it, you know, a special something you eat or drink? And what they found out was it's none of those. The single most important thing is the quality of the relationships we have in our lives. That was also somewhat verified by another study that looked at similar type things around the world called the Blue Zone Study. Dan Buettner's written a book about that from the National Geographic. And he sort of found the same thing in areas of the world where people live to be over 100, but were healthy, had their cognitive faculties. There wasn't a single food they ate. There wasn't a single drink. It was all about having powerful relationships with those in their community. And if we don't have a healthy relationship with our food, everything else just falls apart. That's the foundation of, you know, how we set relationships in our lives. So that wasn't a short answer, but there's a lot to unpack at culinary medicine because it's so fundamental to who we are.
That's amazing. And right now, at least I can personally explain it in my own words from all that. What I've gotten is culinary medicine, depending on the person or the doctor or the chef, is when this practitioner takes scientific and medical facts and statistics to come up with a healthy relationship between food and the person's body, but ensuring that the taste is still maintained in the food, right?
Absolutely, because when you eat that food, you need to have a happy, positive experience. Because if I'm making you unhappy and causing stress and you're worrying about, oh, this is too much fat, and so we're defeating ourselves and we're causing negative. There's a negative variables that we're introducing into our health equation. So, yeah, that's what you said is very much spot on.
Thank you. I actually listened through it and then I was like, wait, I've heard my mom talking about this before happening in restaurants where they take different types of food and replace it with other things that are more healthy and maybe are less in fat or less in salt so that it's much healthier, yet it tastes exactly the same. And to her, because she learned this way long before and culinary medicine was not introduced back then, maybe they didn't have a term for it. But right now there's a term for it, actually. And I think now everybody who is sitting in their household or maybe driving to their workplace listening to this will understand. So I'd like you to tell us, Dr. Mike, what are some challenges you've gone through in this industry throughout the years?
Oh, well, you know, part of the biggest challenge is that this is about, you know, wholesome, authentic food. And what we have found, really looking at the data that's evolved, is, for instance, what they've described. This classification system is called the NOVA classification, developed actually at the university in Brazil, where they showed that it really isn't the fat, it isn't red meat per se, salt per se, that seems to correlate with these diseases, but it's the amount of ultra-processing, the amount we kind of screw up our own food. And the problem with that is that when you bring that information to light, you're not going to be supported. And in fact, there are very powerful forces that don't want that message to get out because it's about big food. It's about big snack. It's about big soda. So to give you an example, a fast food place like McDonald's is not going to support this information. Yet if McDonald's was a country, it would have the 90th largest economy in the world. So you have one fast food company that has an economy that is bigger than some countries around the world. And so that's a lot of power. That's a lot of clout. And so it's been very difficult to get the message out on, people, particularly within the medical field. Some years ago in a book I wrote called The Fallacy of the Calorie, I came out and I said, listen, we've looked at the data, and the cholesterol in the food you eat has no impact on your blood lipid level. So it doesn't matter if you eat a shrimp, that's one of the highest foods in terms of per gram cholesterol concentration. Doesn't matter if you eat the eggs, that's not going to impact your blood cholesterol level. There are other things that come into play. And that got me, as a cardiologist, saying the cholesterol in the food didn't matter. That got me a lot of, you're full of hooey. And, but just a few years ago, about 2-3 years ago, the U.S. government finally came out and they removed the 300 milligram dietary cholesterol guideline and said, there's just never been any evidence for us restricting people's cholesterol intake. The data, the science was no good, which was what I said. Despite that, they said people have listened to us and they've cut the average cholesterol intake in half in the United States, and it's had no impact on diabetes, obesity, et cetera. So a lot of the challenges we face is really that the message is not one that is conducive to being supported by the people that have a lot of money and clout.
Yeah, speaking of being a cardiologist, when I was in high school in my biology class, I remember we were learning about the heart and the veins, and our teacher used to tell us that the more you eat cheese, the more you drink lots of milk with cream, or you eat fatty stuff, that all that fat goes into your bloodstreams, and then one day it will just block your veins and you'll go pop. So then I come back and I realize, wait, some people eat cheese like a lot and it doesn't affect them. Yet other people, no matter how little cheese or any fatty thing they eat, it affects them. Why is this the case that two different people get two different reactions when it comes to the same thing that supposedly is supposed to hurt our cardiological workings or whatnot?
Okay, so a couple of things there to unpack. First, what they told you is completely wrong. Multiple studies, and we teach this in our course, show that full-fat dairy, which is our cheeses, our creams, our butter, etc., has no impact in raising your risk of heart disease. So one of the things we have to understand is that, just what you said, people are different, right? So genetics does play a role in your likelihood and your proclivity to develop heart disease. But when we look at the data, what we find is that it makes full fat dairy has no negative impact. And in fact, certain types of dairy like yogurts, cheeses, etc., fermented things like kefir, etc., actually turn out to be potentially protective. Why? Because they're giving us probiotics and prebiotics as well. And so one of the things we're learning goes back to what you brought up, which you said cheese. But cheese is a very open category, right? There's a slice of American cheese, which is not cheese at all. It's a cheese-like pasteurized food. So if somebody wants to eat a lot of processed American cheese and grilled cheese sandwiches and slices of American cheese on their fast food hamburgers, that food is very different than, let's say, a slice of just aged prosciutto, which is just pork and salt, and a living piece of, let's say, blue cheese, which is fermented, has positive probiotics. So that the way we're thinking about food by saying cheese is really, that's part of the problems that we try to address in culinary medicine. We want to change that perspective and not look at it as cheese, but look at one thing as very processed sort of fake food, one thing as very real fermented food, very authentic food. Then we understand they're not the same. And to give you a great example, I'll just mention this, and people may have heard of this, something called the French paradox, which to this day has never been explained. So this was about, I guess, about 30 years ago in the 1990s. They did a study and they looked at some of the healthiest countries around the world. And the very first country that was the healthiest at that time was Japan. And people said, well, you know, they don't eat a lot of cheese. They don't have a lot of fatty stuff. They're eating sushi and sashimi and seafood and rice and things like that. That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But the second country was France. And we said, wait a second. They eat more butter than anyone in the world. Mm-hmm. They have all these cheeses, like you said.
And bread also.
Wine. They have all these fatty sauces with creams and stuff. And yet their cardiovascular event rate was one half of that in the United States at the time, even though they were doing all the things that doctors were telling people in the United States, heart doctors were telling people, don't do this because you're going to have a heart attack, just like you said. And the French didn't. Now, I will tell you, just like we were talking, the French cheeses were not processed American cheese at the time. Their meats were local. They ate a lot of vegetables, again, kind of locally sourced, etc. So in terms of where their food came from, it was real. Mm-hmm. It was authentic. It was traditional diet, what we'd call today a Mediterranean diet, except they had a lot of butter, creams, etc. Excuse me. So folks look, and they try to find all these reasons. Maybe the French weren't counting the number of heart attacks correctly. And they looked at that and they said, no, they're actually doing a pretty good job. Nobody's ever explained it. And they just kind of put it in a category and they said, it's the French paradox. Maybe it's because they drink more wine and that's good for them. But that's been the mentality. And we can't keep putting things off to the side and say there's an Inuit paradox. There's a French paradox. There's an obesity paradox. And keep pushing things off to the side because it doesn't agree with the way we want it to be. And that's been the problem for decades. And so culinary medicine is about saying, hey, let's look at what the data shows us. And for example, one of the things we've looked at all these outliers, one of the consistent findings is that people are healthy when they eat real food. The more processed and ultra-processed food you eat, the worse your health is going to be, the more at risk you are for things that you were talking about. So it's not the cheese, you know, per se. It's the type of cheese that you're going to have. And in fact, cheese, real cheese that's a fermented living product, has actually been shown to be associated with a risk in your likelihood of having a heart attack when we look at real cheese in a couple of different studies.
Mm-hmm. I actually think when it comes to that, they also should look into the perspective that French people don't eat too much when it comes to cheese itself, because when you look at a cheese platter of a French man and this glass of wine, the cheese is in small cubes and it's hard cheese, so you can't eat too much of it. But then you compare to this other person with a whole bowl of melted cheese and a whole burger on their head, and they just dip it into this melted cheese. How do you expect to have a similar lifestyle with a person who is eating 2-3 cubes of some exotic hard cheese that took maybe months and years to ferment underground? Definitely there'll be a difference. So I presume it's also the perception of how much quantity they intake when it comes to the cheese itself, it also matters, yeah?
Yeah, it's two things. And when we look at, and one of the things we talk about in culinary medicine is the value. So what is the value of the food? Well, that depends on two variables. One is the quality, which we just talked about, and the other is the quantity. And part of the problem, which you brought up correctly, part of the problem in the United States is that we don't pay any attention to quality. So we think, like you were saying, right, it's just a hamburger, right? And we don't look at the difference between something that's grass-finished, maybe a grass-finished bison burger. The animal was raised very humanely. It lived its life, you know, on the farm versus animals that weren't treated very well. They were under stress. They were fed, you know, a GMO feed in those what we call concentrated animal feeding operations or CAFOs. The meat was processed with tons of additives. And so we think of those the same, and we don't look at the quality. So all we look at when we're thinking of food value then is what you said, which is quantity. And we say, oh, if I get two hamburgers for 50 cents, that's a better food value than paying a dollar for this one bison burger. And so then people go and they say, this is a better value, food value, because I'm getting more is better. And more junk is just more junk.
Mm-hmm. And what's the deal between butter and margarine? Because I come from a country where 90% of us use margarine and we are okay. We don't die of heart attacks. But you walk into a different foreign country and they're like, no, butter is better and it's healthier. What's the deal? Because I don't get it. They are both things that you spread on bread and it works just fine. And actually, margarine tastes way better. So what's the difference? Is one good? Is one bad for you? Or is this just a myth when it comes to people's preference?
Part of it, again, will depend on your cultural background. Margarine is very different than butter because butter is actually an emulsion, and it has a saturated animal fat in it. So that's basically what butter is, whether it comes from a goat, a cow, et cetera. Margarine undergoes a man-made manufacturing process where you take unsaturated fats that come in polyunsaturated or monounsaturated vegetable oils, and you what's called hydrogenate them, which means adding extra hydrogen molecules on them so that they are now saturated, essentially. So you're trying to make a vegetable into an animal fat is basically what you're trying to do. And part of the problem with that is you probably heard of things called trans fatty acids. Trans fatty acids only occur in polyunsaturated and monounsaturated types of fats. And that has to do with their orientation in space, what's called cis and trans formations. So what happens is when you heat these vegetable oils to high temperatures, you can create some of what's called these trans fatty acids. And you can get unwanted kinds of compounds. So those types of things have been associated with potentially detrimental outcomes. I had a patient once who told me about something they did with margarine, and I think that really sums it up. So they took margarine and they put it outside, and this was in Florida in a hot summer, and the margarine started to melt, but there were no bugs on it. Because bugs did not recognize it as food. It wasn't a natural substance to them. You might as well put gasoline, you know, on the curb. They weren't interested in it. And so I think that tells you, like, I personally, butter, when we look at the studies, is actually associated with a reduced risk, about a 4% reduced risk of the likelihood of developing type 2 diabetes. It is not associated with increased, risk of cardiovascular disease, not an increased risk of obesity. I don't use margarine. I try to stay away from hydrogenated oils. These types of things are the things that we also see when we deep fry a lot, because we're heating, particularly when you take unsaturated or monounsaturated oils and you put them at those high temperatures, that's where you start to get these configurations. And when people look at the bags, like you get a bag of chips and it says zero trans fats on those chips, even though the chips were deep fried, understand that labeling laws only look at a serving size and parts per million. Meaning that if it's less than so many parts per million, they can say there's zero in there, but it's not really zero. So if you sit down and eat that bag of chips, you actually can be ingesting, you know, a fair bit of trans fatty acids, which have been shown to be awful in terms of starting inflammation. Mm-hmm. Even though legally the bag says zero. And that has to do with the labeling laws. So we can't always just rely on what's on the package of the brand.
Ah, that's great. And when it comes to desserts generally, we all love sweet things, and desserts are probably everyone's favorite on this planet. But there's something that is always peculiar to me. Nitrogen desserts. There are some desserts that they are quoted as hashtag dragon breath. They have like nitrogen in it, and then it causes this fog on the dessert itself. Is it healthy to consume the nitrogen gas itself, or is it not nitrogen they're using? What makes all these crazy desserts?
They can use liquid nitrogen, which freezes it, and then what you see is the sublimation of the very cold nitrogen gas. We need nitrates to live. Nitrogen is an important molecule for us. Nitrogen and all its different forms are things that when we ingest them and our body converts them into certain types of compounds, we use those throughout our body to relax our blood vessels. So it's actually very helpful. People have probably seen, beets, and they sell some beet powder, because it's very helpful. The reason it's helpful is that it contains a lot of nitrogen, a lot of other good compounds as well, but it's a rich source. Beets are one of the richest sources of nitrogen. So when you eat those, your body absorbs them and converts them to those molecules that can help reduce your blood pressure, help relax the vasculature. So nitrogen is actually a very important molecule for us to use. So as far as I know, there's never been any kind of health effects because that nitrogen doesn't really get on the inside of the food. It just freezes on the outside of the food. And then you see that sort of sublimation coming right off of that. So as far as I know, there's never been any kind of danger in there. The nitrogen that's in foods is something that we need. So it's okay to eat foods that have lots of nitrogen in them, like beets or celery is good for us.
I thought that it's actually a bad thing to consume air that's not oxygen. So when it's on food, it scares me a lot. Food that's fogging scares me a lot. That's one thing that I'm terrified of. But you have a number of books that are in a wide genre when it comes to food. I'd like us to walk through these books. Your first book is The Food Shaman, An Art of Quantum Food. What is it all about?
That's actually my latest book. So that's the most recent book. And what that really does, it's looking at the totality of what we talked about earlier, this food experience. And looking at the importance of what I call the softer edges, which is, yes, we do need to pay attention to what we eat, but we have to also look at how we eat, when we eat, where we eat, why we eat, with whom we eat. And all these things will impact that food experience, which in turn impacts our food relationship and our health and wellness down the road. So it kind of looks at this big picture of the food experience. And I call it quantum food because as you and I spoke earlier, the culinary medicine, as we approach it, it's really about shifting the way we look at food, not just looking at categories of fats or carbohydrates or calories, but understanding food really is sort of real food and ultra processed food or not so real food and how that impacts us and how that makes us feel and how that affects that bacteria in us. And, how we feel, in turn affects our health as well down the road.
Mm-hmm. You also have another book, Ancient It, which takes us way back in history when it comes to the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Mayans, the Vikings, and other communities and what they ate and what made them great. So what made you dive into historical and ancient food categories?
Well, because what you and I have been talking about is what are these ill health effects that we've been suffering? And when we look, we really see an increase when we look at the data, really after World War II, and then particularly probably about the last 50 years or so. And if we go back, maybe not that long in time, 100, 150 years ago, we start to see, you know, really everybody was pretty much eating organic food because that's all there was. We didn't have all these processes. We didn't have, you know, big kind of industrial agriculture and manufacturing of food. So when we wanted to look at the health effects of different contemporary diets, and we talked about the French paradox and they knew it, and the Mediterranean diet, so on and so forth, it's also important to look throughout time. And for example, in ancient East, there are two diets that are very different that we look at. So we look at the ancient Greek diet, because that was really the first Mediterranean diet, which is so popular these days. And what we find is, wow, you know, they ate a lot of the foods and some of the recommendations that we had, that we do today. And also, really some big advances in medicine have come not so much from the diet, but really simple things like health and sanitation. So we've really made an impact on infectious disease, particularly, again, through things just like sanitation, just not so much with all the medicines and things like that. We reduced the risk of childbirth, right? You know, back in the day, you know, about 20% of women would die in childbirth. So that was a risk. Young women, you know, were dying in their teens. And so that brought the average life expectancy down. There was trauma, you know, somebody break a leg and a compound fracture and that would get infected. So what we found when we looked at the data is that in the ancient days, so if you were an ancient Roman or an ancient Egyptian, and you managed to survive childbirth and childhood diseases and the wars and the traumas, and you made it till you're about 40 or 50, you were just as likely pretty much to live as long as we do today, which is a pretty amazing thing. And what that also tells us is that they had pretty good nutrition. They had pretty good food because to accomplish that longevity and to develop arts, to conquer empires, right? You've got to be pretty healthy. And so we went back and we looked at what were those things and can we find any of that today? And certainly with ancient Greece, we find a lot of what we like in a modern Mediterranean diet, in the ancient Greek diet. And then we also looked at the Vikings because that's completely different area, completely different time, completely different focus. As you point out, very heavy on sort of the meats and the butters and the very kind of European type cuisine. And yet these folks were incredibly healthy as well. And, you know, they sailed around the world and had, you know, a huge impact in human civilization. And that's just not something you do if, you know, you're suffering from scurvy and malnutrition and you can't grow. So, you know, what was it about what they ate and how they ate? And really we find that these natural foods, these natural diets, and particularly in ancient times, how the diet changed with the seasons. As human beings, we're omnivores, so we're built to eat different foods, and we eat them at different times. And to give you an idea how this works in nature, if you're anywhere in a country where you have deer, I'm in Montana, so we've got lots of deer, and during they like to eat grass and they'll eat the apples and they'll go in and eat lots of, you know, corn and things from fields. And then in the winter, obviously it changes. It's cold. It's dark. And what actually happens is the bacteria in the deer's stomach changes with the seasons. And so they develop these bacteria that are meant to break down very hard foodstuffs like twigs and seeds and, you know, those sorts of things because that's all that's around for them to eat. And people think that they are helping the deer. So they put corn out for the deer in the winter. Well, that the deer will eat that corn, but because it's out of season, their bacteria can't break it down. And the corn that you feed the deer in the winter, which is something that they eat in the summer, will actually kill them in the winter. So feeding deer what they eat in the summer, but feeding them in the wrong season can kill them. And so that, to me, is a kind of a very powerful example of, you know, nature's subtle rhythms with how we move. And I can tell you as a chef, you know, I don't buy tomatoes in January, right? They're out of season. And they're not the same thing that I get out of a garden or a farmer's market that are so sweet because they've got those natural sugars in the summer. Can I get a tomato in January? Yeah. Do I want to eat a tomato in January? No, it's awful. It tastes like cardboard. So, you know, that is something that we want to appreciate too, is, you know, is the rhythms, the things that are around us, those fresh, authentic, real foods.
And also, as we dive into the modern Western diet, you have a different book called The Fallacy of the Calorie, where I presume your cardiologist self dives into this. So what's this all about? Is it similar to the previous book, but in a modernized way?
The Fallacy of the Calorie is a little different. So that really is the scientific basis. So we talk about a lot of data. We talk about a lot of studies, hopefully in an entertaining way. But we really, that sets the foundation, the evidence base for culinary medicine. So we look at things like calories. Are they important? Does something that has less calories, does that mean it's more healthful? And the short answer in that is no. Obviously, the title of the book, The Fallacy of the Calorie, kind of gives that one away. But we look at things like salt. We look at these approaches to food and health that have failed us over the years. And then we look at that data and we explore, you know, why that is and kind of why we need to move on. And understanding that these recommendations that come to us and continue to get pushed on us from the mainstream media and the mainstream, you know, forces that be from 50 years ago, they didn't have access to all these new things that have only come out, you know, within the last decade. So the gut microbiome is something that's really come to the forefront, you know, within the last decade. Things like epigenetics, which is how the environment we live in turns our genes on and off. So it's not that you have these genes that they turn on and they're independent of the environment. It's our interaction. It's our relationship with the environment. And the environment is flicking these genes on and off. Things like nutrigenomics, which look at what are called SNPs or single nucleotide polymorphisms. And they're the kind of unique single point mutations that make you, you and me, me. But they can affect how you and I respond to foods very differently through things called bioactives. So bioactives are not a vitamin or a nutrient or a mineral, but they also act in the foods. And we mostly found them just in the plant foods that we eat that, for example, can turn a gene on. And I'll give you an example. So people of Japanese descent can have a genetic makeup, a nutrigenomic makeup. So when they eat sushi with seaweed, there's a compound in that seaweed that will turn one of their genes on that helps protect them from cancer. Being of European descent, I don't have that gene. So I can eat sushi and I'm going to get lots of nutritional benefit from it because it's good and I'll have a good time because I love sushi and it's delicious. But I don't get the same benefit that somebody who's of Japanese descent and who has that particular gene will get. And that is a study called nutrigenomics, which is also very new. And that also, to me, gives us great insight why this idea that one diet will never work for everybody, because we're also very different. And so you have to find what works for you, for your taste and, you know, your world and where you live and makes you happy, and I have to do it for me, and we can both have diets that work really well and are really helpful for us and follow culinary medicine, but they can be completely different. I mean, we might have completely different flavor profiles, different ingredients. What works for me may not work for you and vice versa, and that's okay. So I want to get people out of this idea that what's the diet I've got to have? It's got to be keto. It's got to be this. It's got to be that. It's got to be sauerkraut or grapefruit or whatever, you know, the flavors of the day. You need to find what works for you. And that's what's important. And that's an important part of culinary medicine because ultimately it comes back to the individual, not just sort of blanket groups.
And to support this, you have another that's Eating Well, Living Better. That's all about a grassroots gourmet guide. And I'm pretty sure the name sells itself. So it's about all foods that are of grassroots descent, right?
Yeah, that was actually my very first book some years ago. So it's got some little stories in there and you know, some recipes, some of which probably need to be updated from when I wrote it, which was a while ago. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that's the very first book that does talk about, you know, what we would call a grassroots approach, which is still very mm-hmm. much, you know, in the culinary medicine course that we teach. Just today, we probably, people talk about in terms of, you know, be a localvore, local foods, fresh foods, authentic foods, but it's all in that same category, yes.
Yeah, and on your website, people can get access to different recipes of main dishes, appetizers, desserts, fermented foods. Are these recipes your very own, or are they shared recipes?
The recipes are all my own creation, so they're 100% mine. I take full credit and I receive full blame if you try one and you don't like it. But yeah, they're recipes, and I always tell folks, you know, look at recipes. You know, I have studied martial arts for many years, many decades, and I used to run a martial arts school and teach martial arts. And I always said, you know, my body at this point in time, I move a certain way. I have a certain skill set. I'm so tall. My arms are so long. I have a certain degree of flexibility. So again, kind of like a diet, what works for me might not work for somebody who's 6'5", you know, 250 pounds and, you know, full of muscles, or somebody who's, you know, 5'2", 90 pounds, you know, a female light frame, you know, doesn't have the same build. But the principles are the same. So no matter if you're 6'5" or 5'2", the principles, I mean, the human body only moves and breaks in so many waves. The principles are pretty universal. And so when you use a recipe, I always tell people follow it the first time. So you know what it's supposed to be teaching you. But each recipe is really teaching you a principle. So, you know, a recipe I have might be showing you how to braise something. A baking recipe might be showing you, you know, how to knead bread. You know, another recipe might be showing you how to whip cream, you know, something like that. So take those recipes, do them, understand what they're teaching you, and then make them your own. So, it's not about just following somebody else and somebody else's recipes and tastes. It's about, you know, taking that lesson and then making it your very own.
You know, Chef, I've always thought that, and it's actually something that it's real when it comes to me, when you're in the kitchen with surrounded by all these pots, pans, the ingredients themselves, and you're on the pan cooking, I've always felt like food itself can sense your fear. It can sense your emotion. So if you're doubting yourself, it will show in the food. If you're anxious, it will show in the food. If you're happy, it will also reflect on the food itself. And if you're mad or angry at somebody, it also shows on the food. So what's your advice to somebody who's willing to take a part in this journey when it comes to culinary arts or maybe culinary medicine itself?
I say, you know, you really summed it up well there. Be happy, right? Because that is a huge impact. And part of what we teach, we touch on it in our introduction course, but our introduction course is more like a whole lot of appetizers because we're showing you kind of what's in culinary medicine if you want to go deeper, which is why it's an introductory course. But one of our more advanced courses is really about mindfulness, and it's about an attitude of gratitude, and it's about happiness. And we're only here, and I can tell you as a physician, I see it, you know, all the time when we're in the hospital, and a lot of people have confronted that with the pandemic, you know, that we've been exposed to over the last year. Life is precious. We're here a short time. So be here in the present. Enjoy it. You know, every meal you have, every bite you have, you know, whomever you are dining with, even if you're just dining with yourself, you know, make it a wonderful experience. You know, have a happy life. And what we find is that when we have that positive experience, when we have an attitude of gratitude, when we're happy and positive, it goes back to what we talked about, which is that Harvard happiness study. And we find ourselves, you know, living a long life, living, you know, a well life, a healthy life, et cetera. And I guess the corollary to that, as you pointed out, is you don't want to be eating food from an angry chef.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You're taste the salt in it. Like 100%.
There's something
called the salt that will be in the food.
It'll be bitter.
The spices. I don't know what happens with the hands, but it just acts out. It's like you have a small person in your brain telling you, add that salt, that's not enough. But I get you, and that's some great advice. And what do you hope for? Let's say 20 years in the future, what do you hope will be the relationship between us humans and the food we eat itself?
Well, I hope one of the things we teach in culinary medicine is that we are able to change our perspective. And culinary medicine, as I spoke with you, it's about an individual. So you've got to have the diet that sustains you, and not just nutrition from a nutrition aspect and like so many of these nutrients and RDAs and things, but sustains your soul, you know, as a person and a human being. And in that way, we also want to practice and enjoy and sustain our communities and by extension, the planet. So I'm hopeful that culinary medicine will play a big role in helping us as individuals be happier and healthier, but also that means our relationship with each other, you know, and with the planet. And that's what I'd love to see, you know, culinary medicine continue to be able to push us towards accomplishing those ends.
And I hope that comes true, because not a lot of people out there realize that diets are not for everybody. Some people will take the road of eating like a rabbit. You eat greens only and it works for you. For some other person, you decide to be a carnivore. You're eating meats and it works for you. Yeah. For some other person, you eat carbohydrates. It works for you. But to others, you eat absolutely anything and it also works out for you.
Yes.
So I think that culinary medicine will actually, in the future, be the perfect directive for every single person. Once you realize who you are, what you should eat, what's good for you, and what tastes great from what you've selected, I think that would work for everybody. Because I don't think it's good to eat something that doesn't taste great, yet it's supposed to help you. I'm pretty sure everybody will not manage to finish the platter itself if it doesn't satisfy your tongue palate itself. But anyway, Mike, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on this episode. I loved having you here. So many questions of mine have been answered, especially when it comes to culinary medicine. At least now I'm not that confused. And whoever is listening right now, you can go on to his website at chefdrmike.com. From there, you can buy his books, get his online course, watch his videos, his blog, get his recipes about different sorts of food, and I'll link it in the description, obviously, so that it's easier to find him. But thank you so much for joining us. And we'd love to have you here again. I'm pretty sure after this, people will have questions.
Love to come back and chat again. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Absolutely. Goodbye.
And that will be it for this week. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe so you're notified when a new episode is posted. Rate and review this podcast on your favorite podcasting app, especially Apple Podcasts, and share it with all your friends. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, creativity is intelligence having fun. Until next time, #PodRock.